I have been feeling oh so blue. I always thought that you would love me. I don't know what I should do. Do do.
Hello, hello, and good evening to each and every one of you. Thank you so much for joining me here tonight on another segment of Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. I am your host, C. Maria Wall. Thank you so much for being here tonight. How was your week? I sincerely hope that it was better than it was the week before. And if it was not, you know what? Just keep moving. Put one foot in front of the other because you will make it if you keep moving forward. So we're going to jump right into our show this evening. Tonight, we are continuing our Greatness in You series all the way around. And my guest tonight is author David Tabatsky. And let me tell you a little bit about David. He has such an interesting, wonderful life and career. But tonight, we're going to be talking about his latest book, Write for Life, Communicating Your Way Through Cancer. And of course, we're going to be talking about, as I said earlier, David's wonderful, wonderful journey. So sit back, relax, and enjoy our time together. So let me tell you a little bit about David. In his own words, David states, "My father was diagnosed with leukemia in 1986, and he died less than a year later. At the time, no one spoke much about his illness as if it would go away if they didn't. And he said that he never heard anyone mention any other option besides medicine for his father or any of those who loved him. Eventually, years later, David figured out that writing and communicating in general about his father and cancer could be helpful, both for him and for those who have come in contact with the both of them. Write for Life, both the book and the foundation, are a continuation of his discoveries along the way. He's been fortunate to work on a number of related book projects. Just a small list includes the cancer book, 101 Stories of Courage, Support, and Love by the Chicken Soup for the Soul Publishing Company. He's co-author with Elizabeth Baer, an editor. And just the word, Reclaiming Your Life Through Cancer, beautifully. Chicken Soup for the Soul Publishing again. Consulting editor, The Right Words at the Right Time, Volume 2, Your Turn, by Marlo Thomas. Atria Books editor, Slipping Reality by Emily Beaver. From Author House, co-author with Adele Blumberg, and editor, Liar, How I Faked My Way Through Colitis and Crohn's Disease and Lived to Survive Colon Cancer Twice. This is just such a small part of this wonderful, wonderful individual's journey. So with that said, we're going to jump right into our show. We're about to welcome David, but before we do, welcome to all of our guests coming into the chat room and, of course, in our call query. Thank you so much for being here. Before we end the show, we will open up the lines for you if you have questions or comments. And if you're logged on as a guest in our chat room, If you'd like to participate, you can call us at 646-478-4726. Press the number 1 on your phone to get into our call query to let me know that you'd like to be on air. Or you can log in with a screen name in our event, in our show chat room. That way you will be able to participate. And if you're over on our Facebook event page, I will be checking there periodically for questions and comments as well. So with that said, we're going to welcome David to our show. So David, welcome to Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio.
Thank you, Maria. I'm glad to be here with you.
I am so glad that you reached out, and once I sent out that invitation that you accepted, because my goodness, as I told you earlier, we were speaking briefly, you have such an interesting life and career, but let's just start at the beginning where your bio that I read began back in the day when you found out that your father had, I guess back then you may not have known the severity of his illness, but you knew that your father was sick.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think we knew intellectually, you know, the science, like leukemia is not a good thing. That was clear. But there was no, outside of the doctor and the little quick conversation you'd have with the doctor to find out what's going on, there was no other resource. No one else was having any dialogue. Obviously, there was nothing. There was no internet to go look on. There was no support groups. There were no nothing. The hospital where he would get treatment, they didn't have any kind of support group for families or caregivers or anything like that. So, yeah, we were really limited. And I think even the doctors didn't talk about it much. Or culturally, it was like, well, that's something doctors talk about amongst themselves. But patients and their families, they're limited in what they can understand because they're not doctors. So I think that's, and the landscape of that obviously has changed. You know, this is 26, 7 years ago. So there's a whole new generation, a couple generations in there. So that's all changed a lot. But yeah, it was also as if there was maybe a myth attached to it that if you didn't talk about it, maybe it wouldn't be true. I mean, it was sort of like denial built into the system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in a way, I mean, a certain amount of denial is always good. I think we as human beings, we need to have, you know, a certain amount just to, you know, get through the day. But in an appropriate dose, this was sort of like almost blanket denial.
Right. And I think that to a degree, that was a sign of the times back then.
There was like a taboo. It was like people at that time too wouldn't talk about divorce. If somebody in the neighborhood was getting divorced, you would kind of talk around it. Same thing, like you don't say out loud that someone has cancer, because as if there's a stigma, like there's something wrong with them. They must not be a whole human being if they got cancer.
Right.
Maybe anybody in their family. Yeah, yeah, exactly. People don't go near the family because they might have it too. I mean, it was almost like that, I think, in certain places where people were ignorant, who really just didn't know any better. Or you felt like, well, we can't say anything because they're stricken with this thing that's, you know, just otherworldly almost. It's almost like there was an alien disease.
Right.
Those were kind of odd times, yeah.
And I'm not so sure that for some it's changed that much now, because it's almost like a lot of times now, even when someone says, I have cancer, or someone has cancer, so many people automatically think death sentence.
Well, yeah, I think you're right. You make a really good point. We shouldn't assume that just because we're living in such seemingly progressive times and there's such a huge availability of information, you know, and support and all that kind of stuff, it doesn't mean that the basic mentality hasn't changed in a lot of places, because people still have a predisposed, take on all of that, where they,
right.
they think that's somebody else's thing. It doesn't, you know, and if I keep it at arm's distance, it won't affect me. That's a problem for somebody else. There's a lot of that. And people, in spite of all the available information, it's amazing how uninformed or how minimally informed people are about the particulars of lots of different sicknesses. People also think the same thing about a lot of other illnesses or diseases. Yeah. So.
And when you, after your father had passed, and you, I guess you could say that you got that epiphany that, wow, maybe it's time for us to give a voice. I guess we could say that, give a voice to the illness.
Well, yeah, it took a long time for me to come to that, because I think I didn't have, I was in a career that was built upon communication and creativity and all of that. I didn't have the tools, and I didn't see them anywhere around me for coping with, digesting, processing what had happened to me on a personal level. So, yes, I was able to find creative ways to make theater and circus and all of these things all over the world, and I did that for a long time. But those same tools and all that training, in a way, at least at the, you know, over all those years, never announced to me like, oh, look a little deeper into what all these things you've done, and that's there lies the potential for you to deal with what happened with your dad and all of that, and to understand it better and then learn something from it and you make it useful to help other people. It took a long time to get to that point, and I didn't even know that it wasn't even an option. I didn't even see it as an option for the longest time. It just didn't even occur to me. Even though I was doing a lot of work, all my life, I've used theater and circus arts, working as a teacher, using it, working with special ed kids and also doing a lot of clowning with children going way, way back, who were sick with cancer and other pediatric illnesses, and working in hospitals and other places, working with senior citizens who were ill, working with people performing for people with mental illness of all different kinds. So I was exposed to all that, but it never really dawned on me to connect into my own experience in the cancer world, because it was also brief. Like you said, it was less than a year from diagnosis to death, and it was a kind of a blur in that regard.
So I guess in some way,
and in my father's case, maybe in a blessing in a way, he didn't go through any long drawn out suffering from the treatment. It was like he kind of went, there's three stages that one can have in that type of leukemia, and he was in stage one for most of it, and he basically skipped stage two and went at the very end, literally in a week, and went analyze it. He basically skipped stage two, went to stage three, and he was gone. It was real quick.
Mm-hmm.
And the worst thing he had was fatigue. It was his constant, he had,
right.
He went through real bouts of fatigue, but never pain, really. I don't remember that being an issue for him.
Do you think that somewhere in the back of your mind, though, what, in other words, I guess I'm saying, you were saying that you were working with people who were ill and all of that. Do you think that somewhere in the back of your mind, it was there subconsciously, and at what point was what happened that ignited it and brought it back to the forefront for you to want to put a voice to this experience?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that there were several moving parts to that, on professional and personal levels, and also what's happening externally. So the cancer community became a community. There are a lot of disparate elements that raised enough money and voice and education to become a really a vibrant, viable community. You know, even at that time, I don't even remember anything about the American Cancer Society existed, but it wasn't all over the place. There was no Susan G. Komen Foundation. There was no cancer care.
Right.
There were none of these big, American Cancer Society was basically the only organization that I could say that I had ever heard of at that time. But it was in the distance, you know, it was in the distance. And so with the advent of all of that and with the legislation that came politically and even in the National Institute of Health and where they raised the consciousness, with the increase in the frequency of people getting cancer too, we were talking about before. I mean, the numbers are just, you know, they've gone up and up and up, and that's, I think, when, you know, it's caused by environmental things and it's caused by poison in our food system. It's caused by a lot of things, obviously, but that was happening. And then on a personal note, yeah, I guess I tried to still, even though on a very low level, I was trying. You digest the loss of a parent; it never really ends. I mean, I'm still doing it as we speak. But then becoming a parent myself 20 years ago changed that paradigm for me too. So I suddenly had a different lens on looking at the world all across the board when you become a parent. It changes everything entirely. And then again, you know, 2 years after that, when my daughter was born, it increases that lens. It amplifies it even more. And you know, when you get older and you start to reflect on things, you start to reassess the value of what you're doing with your life professionally. And then all of that happening, and then being asked. The book that I did in 2005, we were working on it. The book I was doing with Marla Thomas. Some of the stories that I was working on personally were with people who had cancer, experience with cancer, and their stories that they were telling in the book that I was helping them tell. Were related to that. And then soon after that, I was asked by Chicken Soup for the Soul Publishing to do this book that became known as the Cancer Book. And then that was in 2008 that I did that. It came out in 2009. So it's not that, it's only 5 years ago that book came out, 6 years ago that I was working on it. But that just shifted everything for me. That really changed a lot. The experience of doing the book. I mean, I did the whole thing by myself, essentially, as far as vetting all the stories and looking through.
Hello.
Maria?
We are having technical difficulties here. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I just lost you there for a second. I didn't know.
Yeah. Technical difficulties. I'm so sorry.
No, we're back okay now.
I was saying
like in 2008 when I was working on, I was reading through like 2,000 submissions of stories and poetry and stuff for the cancer book, for what became the cancer book. That was a life-changing experience for me. Also, I lost my mom in 2007. Not to cancer, but still in all. So I was working on that book very soon after the whole experience of losing her, and she had been sick for a while. So it wasn't a sudden thing, you know. And so I've been in hospitals and been around illness and all of that, and like I said, not cancer, but in a way it doesn't matter.
Right. That's what I was about to say.
No, it really doesn't. I mean, the essence of it doesn't matter. And so that really colored my view of it. And at the same time, my children are getting older. And so, just the combination of all of that had me looking at it in a much different way.
Yeah.
And I suppose that I would say, yeah, that a lot of things crystallized in that time.
And when you started writing, because as I said earlier in your intro, you've done so many books, and I guess that once the voice was there for you, you have continued to do that. So let's just delve into some of that, because
uh-huh.
I do have questions, because one of my my life coaching group, I have people from all over the world, so I do have a list of questions that they put in, because some of them are in bed right about now in their country. So I do have some questions there as well that people would like to get your responses on. But
oh, sure.
Let's talk about Your Right for Life, because number one, I love the title, because that's what I do. My books that have pieces of my life and the lives of others that I've come across, I, as you say, when you do it in the world of art, I do everything in poetic form. So I take people's stories in my life and I present it in poetic form so that it's my way of expressing it, but it's putting a different spin on it where it's not all of the actual dread and sorrow, but it's a way that people will be enticed to continue to read while they know that they're not alone, but they're also getting what they need out of it or a piece of their roadmap so that they can survive and move forward. So, Right to Life, Communicating Your Way Through Cancer was such a wonderful title. I thought it was such a wonderful title because I think that in some way, for some it may be larger than others, but when we express what we're going through in our experiences, somehow it makes the journey a little bit easier to bear. Or it takes some of that burden off, because when we keep it all inside, it could also cause us as the caregivers or the person with the illness to deteriorate. So where does your book begin? Tell us a little bit about this book and what our viewers and our listeners are going to see when they open the pages.
Well, it's just what the subtitle says, is to communicate your way through. The whole thing is to look at really from, I designed it in a way from the point of diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first section of the book is, it's all about me. Because
mm-hmm.
when someone's diagnosed, it really is just all about them, and they need to figure out who they are and be selfish
right.
in the best way to identify that. But they can't just stay internalized. They've really got to go out there in
right.
in spiritual ways and in very pragmatic, practical ways. And the first thing simply is, I reflect this in my workshops too, and I tell people, I say, well, you're going to go to your appointment to see your doctor, whether it's a second opinion or it's the first appointment after you've been diagnosed, to really get into the weeds about what you're going to do and figure out, and your doctor's going to talk to you about your game plan and really explain everything to you. And you're going to go in to that appointment. Now, everybody's all in there with their already with their questions, right? And I see people going, looking at me confused, and I was going, and I get pretty direct with them. I say, there's somebody in this, even one person in this room, who would go to their doctor's appointment after, and not have a list of questions prepared. Are you really? And
right.
I kind of laugh because I'm like, oh, are you kidding me? Like, you're going to remember? Your whole life has just been turned upside down. You're scared. You everything has just gone crazy, and you're going
right.
to think you're going to remember everything, or your doctor, who's going to see, 75 other patients that day, he or she is going to remember everything. They don't even know you. How are they going to know what you want to know? So
exactly.
That's something that, first of all, writing is just very useful. You got to write down the questions and then share them with the person who's going to go to that appointment with you, and do like a rehearsal. Say the questions out loud. Is that you asking the questions? Are you going to get what you want from the doctor? Because it's your appointment. It's for you. You got to be selfish and make it productive and useful and beneficial for you. However difficult some of those questions are, you got to ask them. And so that's what I do. I try to cut to the chase with all that. So that's the first section of the book, is all about trying to get a sense of self. And then what do you do with that sense of self? You need to put it out there in the world with your family, your friends, your coworkers, your medical team. And that happens in the second half, you know, with there's me, you, and us. Basically, the book is divided into three sections. And so there's, again, you know, people have to figure out who they are in this time, because it changes you. It's going to change you. Even for some people, literally right away, on the day of diagnosis, suddenly they, you know, it's like somebody just pulled your clothes off in the middle of the shopping mall and said, "Now be the same person that you were a few seconds ago. Now you're naked. Everything about your life is going to be exposed to this because of this diagnosis."
And the one thing that I noticed about your book, and I love the titles alone within the book, the first part that you said was, and I always do this, I even have up one of my videos on my YouTube channel, it's entitled, "I Am." Because it's amazing how many people, if I say, "Who are you?" and they're in perfect health, they don't know who they are. They can't tell me who they are. They can't just say, boom, 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 boom. You know, but when you're hit with this type of a curveball or a sideliner or a bump in the road, whatever you want to call it, it's so important to know when you look in the mirror and you're talking to the person that you see, "I am." I can say that if I was diagnosed right now, I would know that I would be able to tell the person looking back at me, I'm not the person I was just last week.
The thing is, it's going to change you so rapidly and so deeply. That's what I see over and over, that you have to know from whence you've been changed and from where your starting point is, because you're going to get shifted out of that point. And if you don't root yourself, you'll be rudderless. And this is what happens when any trauma hits. We need to have that gravity, or we float away into some non-productive oblivion kind of. And so we also have people who depend on us. So if you're a parent or you're a child of people who depend on you for things, you're still going to want to be that provider and that rock and that person for others. That doesn't necessarily just disappear also. So those are, and I think, you know, in the society that we live in, we do a lot of labeling. And so those are fallbacks to look back on that. Is "I am" can mean I am a spouse, a father, a son, a neighbor, a coworker, all of those things. What do all those things mean? And how am I investing myself into each one of those? But at the same time, to be in touch with our feelings, to say, "I am scared."
Right.
And I'm going to say that right out there. I am scared. I am hurting. I am hungry. I am tired. You know, all those things. It's a willingness to acknowledge what's on the surface, and the curiosity, even amidst this trauma, having the curiosity to dig deeper. So it's a combination of those things, and they kind of need, ideally, you want them to coexist, and that's where that's where when you reach out to other people, they can help to enable that. But it's not going to happen all by itself.
Right.
You know, the person who has been diagnosed needs to drive the ship as much as possible.
And I think that that's where the problem comes in, that so many people suddenly, they could have been the CEOs of companies, they could have been the family matriarchs and patriarchs, and suddenly they don't even know who they are anymore. It just is a total shock to their everything, to their heart, mind, body, spirit, soul, and psyche, that they're lost. And you have all of these people who are dependent on you, and that's actually one of the questions on my list from one of my group members in, I believe, the UK, is the fact, what do you do? How do you come home from a doctor's appointment and tell the family, you know?
Well, that's a whole other ball of wax is communicating it, and what Elizabeth Baer called languaging. Like, what language do we choose to use? First, to what does it sound like to us to say whether somebody says, and this is different for everybody, whether they say, I have cancer, to use that word have, or I have been diagnosed with. Now, two people could say the same thing, and it will mean somewhat slightly different. Like, one person will say, I will never say I have cancer because I refuse to possess it. You know what I mean? I won't let it.
Right.
And that's sort of their fighting words. Those are, you know, and for another person, it's like, you know what? The rhetoric doesn't matter to me. You can say it 100 different ways. The fact is still the same. Let's just deal with it. But that's okay too. Everybody, there is no right or wrong with that in how you language it. You have to first language it for how it feels best for you.
Mm-hmm.
And then figure out how do I communicate it appropriately depending on who I'm telling. You know, if you're telling your children, you want to be careful about and get advice when you need it what's age appropriate. And also it's a question of dosing. A lot of things is people, either they're afraid to say anything. I mean, I have a friend of mine whose husband's, this is a dear friend who I've known since college, and I was visiting with her the other day, and her husband lost his mom this past spring, and she was diagnosed with cancer 5 years ago, didn't tell anybody, only her husband knew, and he didn't tell anybody.
Mm-hmm.
It was like their own little secret, trying to protect everyone. And then suddenly, a month before she died, that's when she, you know, because she got so sick, she had to go in the hospital. Everybody had to find out. You know, you don't just go into the hospital in such severe state and not tell anybody. So they knew, they found out, and she was gone a month later. And they had a month to basically to digest the fact about something that she'd had for 5 years. So I'm not suggesting there's a right or wrong there, because who am I to judge that on other people? But, you know, there might have been a better middle ground, let's just say, for communication amongst your family. And so it's a complicated thing. It's a complicated thing. I think it's really informed by our upbringing and our culture and what kind of religion we're affiliated with, and how they deal with things, and everybody comes from different societies,
right?
And so there's a different pattern for how to share that information. Some are much more outgoing and upfront about things. Others are discreet to the point of withholding.
Right. And I have to admit that I'm probably, as I, you know, shared with you earlier when we were conversing, is the fact that I had a life-threatening illness last year. My family showed their true colors across the board in so many ways. And, you know, pretty much I am a loner. And I know that if things were to happen again like they did last year, I would probably end up, you know, not telling them. Because I don't want, for me, this is me to all the listeners, this is my choice, my decision, is the fact that I don't want a bunch of fake people around me just because they feel obligated because they weren't there when I was in good health and living. Don't come around me now that you know that I'm in stage four and they tell me that I have 60 days to live. I want to live every moment happy as I can be. I personally, to all the listeners, this is me talking. I already said I don't want any of the chemo. I don't want any radiation. I just want to live whatever time I have. And if I can keep my spirits up and I'm still feeling well, guess what? I'm going to keep living life my way. But again, that's me. That's my situation. I know that, you know, you haven't had a chance to, you read some of my bios and things, but my situation is very tumultuous. And it's one of those things where I had to make those hard decisions in advance. There are some things, because of what I had gone through last year, I've already set things in place where certain family members will get things sent to them and everything is taken care of and they know this is what needs to happen if this happens and that happens. I've already put it in place, but I only want the positive and the happy around me, and I want to keep doing this. I want to be here for my people and my coaching groups. I want to be here for my listeners all over the world as long as I can be. So in order for me to do that, for me, everyone, for me, I've come to the conclusion that being around certain people would just bring me down, which my belief is that it would make my illness get worse a lot quicker because I'm around so many negative people.
This is crucial, and I think that everyone has to make their individual choice, but that by itself is so important. My friend Jamie out in Arizona I don't know exactly how old she is. I think she's in her 30s, and she has two children who are like 12 and 10, and she's battling a second round of cancer. She had cancer when she was in her 20s, and she got through that, and now she's gotten walloped with another one, and she just said to me, "Man, I'm just eliminate negative people. I got to get you know, from my ex-husband on down the line. I just got to get, you know, if you don't have anything good to tell me, then I don't want to hear anything else. And if you're going to ask me, remind me of how tough it is for me, that's not helping me.
Right.
That's not making it any less tough. I don't need to be reminded. I can feel, you know, I can feel the port poking into my chest without you reminding me that it's there.
Right.
So, you know, let's go get our nails done. Let's go to a movie.
Exactly.
Let's go help some other people. Let's go to church. Let's do a whole lot of productive things. And let's not sit on the you know what. And I think that I just love how open and frank and forward she is about that. I can feel like I'm not with her when she's telling other people, but I can be confident knowing like she's just putting it right out there, but with a smile, saying thanks but no thanks.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, at the same time, we want to own life when it's going real good, right? You want to be
right.
Like, wow, I want to stand up there with my chest puffing out when I get the prize and I get the gold watch. Well, you want to stand proud and present and conscious when it's not going well also, because it's still life and it is your life. And this is what is happening. And it's just, you know, when people say that's the way it is what it is. Well, that is literally true. And so just commit to it, whatever it may be, you know. But at the same time, it is not defining you. So it's sort of like doing both, isn't it, Maria? It's like, do you find yourself sometimes it's almost, you can laugh at it and go, well, it's a little schizophrenic because, you know, like,
right.
I have these people who I think are pretty smart, and they're sensitive, and they have a good sense about all of this stuff, and they're telling me, like, own
mm-hmm.
it, and then they're also telling me, don't own it, you know,
correct.
Like, don't let it own, or not, it's like, own it, but then don't let it own you. So it's a little confusing, but I think we know, if we don't get too caught up in our head, we know in our heart what all that means.
Right, and we have a couple of comments coming in the Facebook chat room, the events chat room. Victoria Prince writes, she says that her mom always told her before she left this world to give her flowers while she could still smell them, and that's exactly it. You know, live life
yeah.
while we can. Don't wait until, you know, I'm gone or I'm almost gone, and then you want to be there and try to, you know, do things that you didn't do when you had the chance to do them. Because for me, I see through all of that. That's me, but I see through all of that. And I don't need that type of negativity and the disingenuous people around me. And Thomas writes, yeah, whoever you surround yourself with contributes to your joy, peace, and purpose, or they take away from it. We must guard our inner circle, and that does not exclude family members. We have to be honest with ourselves, love them, but if they are toxic, keep them where they need to be.
Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely. Well said, and it's so concise. Really, like, wow, that's really great. I know I'm doing that with myself all the time because I have enough, I probably produce enough of my own toxicity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't need anybody else's to add to it. I got my, you know, just when I get, you know, bummed out or depressed about certain stuff myself or frustrated or all those things, I really don't need anyone else to either point it out or to add, certainly not to add to it. No, that's why I think sometimes, like, you know, withdrawal and to withdraw and step back
mm-hmm.
is also, it's a way to yield. And yielding is a really, really important step in this whole process. You know, the language is so much we hear from a lot of different organizations, the fight against cancer. And,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, that's a certain part of it. And there needs to be a certain fighting spirit, let's say,
mm-hmm.
to quote unquote beat it. Or to cope with it, and all. But there also needs to be a certain amount of yielding, to understand
right.
that my body does have something sick in it right now, and I also have to let I can. It doesn't mean to yield. Doesn't mean to give in.
Right.
Saying okay, I quit. Yielding isn't quitting. I think that's a lot of people because we live in a very black and white world. But if you look on the highway, yielding doesn't mean don't enter on this lane. It means let other traffic come through that's maybe going faster and wait your turn when it's safe to go. That's what yielding
right.
is, right? So it's not saying don't go on the highway.
Right.
Yielding, like, okay, give up getting to where you want to go. No. But it's understanding that you may not get there at the same speed.
Right.
And so I think that's really an important thing in life in general, that we're not
right.
constantly fighting. Everything isn't a battle to fight.
Right. And
that
I
there's
think,
a certain.
I think that wording is everything. I do believe that wording is everything. For me, you know. For me, I always say you're going on this journey or this detour called cancer or your journey with cancer, something that's more empowering than a fight. Because if I'm in greatest of health and I'm tired, I'll tell people, man, I'm tired of fighting. I'm tired of fighting. And if I walk into the doctor's office and get that dreaded diagnosis tomorrow and someone says, well, now you have to fight this, again, that word, fight for me. I'm getting older. I'm getting tired of fighting. fine. If the doctor tells me that I have cancer, it's going to be okay. Now I'm on a detour, or I'm on another journey, or something that empowers me as opposed to giving me, taking away my will to want to keep going. Because at this point, when you bring up the word battles and wars and fighting, I'm tired.
I think we're doing that all the time, though. We all are doing that every day with one thing or another. It could be something small. I mean, you know, you might be used to parking, not you, but anyone, could be used to their normal parking spot at work or when they go shopping. And suddenly, wow, I'm not parked in the first row at the Stop and Shop when I go do my food shopping. Oh, somebody's thrown me off my daily habits. Now I'm suddenly, for some reason today, the parking lot was full and I had to park like 300 yards away. And then you think, okay, well, now you have 300 yards to walk. It's where you get a little exercise, and you're going to be thinking about what you want to buy before you go in there and just make a bunch of impulsive purchases. So you got to look at what else it affords you when these things happen. And so I hear all the time from all the patients, pretty much all the patients I work with, say, this has really made me revisit what my daily life is, and also what's even going on in life in general. And the same thing for the caregiver and for each other. And the caregiver sees the person they're caring for with new eyes, and vice versa. And so this is a remarkable opportunity. Not that you wish for it, right? But when it's given to you, there is a gift in it, in a weird sense. I think it's smart to see the potential for that gift. Is it the plan that you wanted? No, nobody wants that. You didn't have a choice. You know, we don't get a choice. We don't get a choice how tall we're going to be, what color hair we're going to have, or any of that stuff. It's like, you know, that's one of the conflicts as human beings, is we want to be entitled to everything and have a choice in everything, but the fact is we don't. We're born into a certain thing. Things are dictated by our environment, by the weather, by luck, by, you know, all that stuff. And so you kind of just have to you have to navigate your way through it all. But what I'm trying to do with Right for Life is give people a better, give them a toolbox. And for some people, a bigger or better one, or other options in their toolbox that they might not have had before. That's really all it boils down to help you get a better sense of yourself, to help you communicate better, to help you reach out to the people that care about you and help them reach out to you. That stuff to me, I think, is really vital and kind of irreplaceable. So I always feel like, you know, if that stuff can help them, and in the workshops I do, and the conferencing and the one-on-one sessions I have with patients and caregivers and staff too, hopefully just giving them, you know, another way to navigate that journey.
Yes. And the Facebook events chat room, Victoria writes, she says that she's learning that in any trials in our lives, we have to change our perceptions. And that's true. We do. We have to change our plan. You know, the road that we were traveling on, we just suddenly hit a major roadblock or detour. So we have to.
It is. That's what it is. It's like you're driving on the highway, and then suddenly the road's closed because they're doing construction, or there was, the weather cracked the pavement, and you can't drive on it safely, so you got to go a different direction. Your flight got canceled. What are you going to do?
Right.
You know, you're going to give up and, like, jump into the river? No. You find another. You find another way. Either you find another flight, or you find another means of transportation. Same thing going to happen when you get sick. People are doing it all the time who get diagnosed with diabetes. That's a mm-hmm. monkey wrench thrown into your life, mm-hmm. and people adapt all the time. I remember when my aunt was diagnosed with diabetes several years ago, but the first time I was with her. It was many, many years ago already. And I was sitting with her, and like she says, "Oh, excuse me, just a second." And she just pulled her skirt up, partway up. And this is mm-hmm. my aunt, my aunt of an older generation. And she just stabbed herself in the thigh with a dose of medicine, and then mm-hmm. just carried on the conversation. And I was so impressed with how she had already adapted, because I remember when she was first diagnosed, it was a really severe change for her, as it would be for anyone. Mm-hmm. But shortly later, it wasn't that much longer, that much later, that this happened to be with her and I observed this, and she just had already taken it in stride so well. And I think, people are doing that all the time. And one of the things is, because we get so deep into our own experience, that's where writing can help, because it gives us a chance to step back. Or step sideways, or whatever direction you want to use metaphorically, and mm-hmm. observe through a different lens, through our own sense of objectivity, and through objectivity that books like Write for Life can provide through their prompts and exercises. Lots of other books can too. This one is more specifically directed for the issues that people are dealing with, with cancer. So that helps, because you got to break it down into something accessible, something bite-sized, something accessible, something manageable to wrestle with. Otherwise, yeah. it's just too big and dramatic, and I'm just going to go back to bed and get under the covers, right? So, and that's where's that going to get you? So, that's really what what is tangible to help people,
And I think that there was one part in your book you were speaking about the song "The Journey to Nowhere," and like you said, I'm just going to use the title in itself: "The Journey, The Road to Nowhere." But let's talk about "The Road to Nowhere" or "The Journey to Nowhere." Whereas, like you said, some people are going to just jump back in the bed, put the covers over their head, and forget about it. And you were just speaking about diabetes, and it runs on my father's side of the family. So I used to watch my aunt, she'd be cooking and she'd stop and she'd start to, need her fingertips and move around. I'm like, "What are you doing?" And she's like, "I need a spot to take my medicine and blah, blah, blah." And she'd get out the little thing to test their sugar first. And I'm sitting up here, and then she'd do that. And then if she needed a shot or whatever, she'd do that. And then she'd get up and finish cooking. And I'm like, "Okay." But then I know some people who are diabetics who eat the candy, they're in denial, they don't want to address the issue, and they don't realize they drink a lot of diet sodas, several a day, which is horrible when you're a diabetic. But, again, it's all about the choices that we make. And to me, it's either you're going to continue living, or you're going to give up, lay down, put the covers over your head, and wait for death to come knocking at your door. Because one thing, the human spirit is a beautiful thing, but once we start to neglect it and we give up, everything just falls apart, and we do lose the battles.
Oh, but it'll break down. People will break down. We see this happen to people all the time. I mean, just the difference of... depending on where you live, if you're in any city of any size, you see it all the time when you see people who are homeless. And some people deal with it in one way, and some in another. Some you know, and but it's the same thing. If you look, if you go into a room and you sit in a room where people are waiting for their chemo, and you look around, you see the different faces, and some people are there, and it's just another thing on their day, and they're gonna get through it, and it's, and some of it's gonna, not necessarily in that moment, but they know that within a certain amount of hours or days, it's gonna suck. They're gonna be sick, and then they're gonna get past the sick few days, and they'll feel okay again. And others have already given up. They're there only because somebody told them you got to be there at 10 o'clock, and they're just dutifully showing up, but they're not, they already gave up. And you can see it. And you hope that you're wrong. You hope that they're just having a bad day. And everybody is entitled also to go under the covers sometimes and to give up for a little while, you know. I think everybody does that to a certain extent, whether they're sick or not. You know, and just, and that's also, that's a certain kind of yielding too, just to say, you know what, I'm gonna lay low here, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna, and there's some healing in there, and knowing when I got to do some healing. Like, I don't really want to go out and socialize now because I'm just gonna have to make it up. It's not in me, so I need to stay quiet and stay alone and heal so that I have something to give when I go out next time. And there's nothing wrong with that. People have to be careful too, not to overcompensate and try to make up something that's not genuine. And I think that, you know, good communication is key to doing that, communicating well with yourself and then also, you know, with you know, obviously with others, to navigate through that.
Yeah, and one thing that we haven't touched on yet, but we had spoken about briefly in our private conversation was, you know, we're going to move up and we're going to start talking about the caregivers, because a lot of who I work with now are the caregivers, and so many of them. Are some, the person has passed on and they are at a place now where they have to clean out their belongings, or their belongings have been shifted to their homes for them to sit through alone, or they may or may not have help. And then there are other caregivers who try to have their lives. And one person sent in a question, which was, you know, I'm feeling like I'm suffocating and I'm losing my sense of self. What can
I
do?
Right. I know. Yeah. I know. You told me a little bit about this before, and I think there's many people in this predicament, and whether mm-hmm. I think we have to first, it helps to look at two things that are happening, especially in the case of. It can happen often in the case of cancer, is when someone goes through a long period of treatment, and then mm-hmm. when the treatment doesn't work anymore, and they die, then there's two things that the person who is remaining is remaining to deal with. And it's not often we just focus on the fact, oh my God, how will I recover? How can I possibly go on without them? And that's a fair question. It happens to all of us, you know. When we lose somebody we love who's close to us, there's no doubt. But the other thing that I think often gets overlooked is there's a healing has to come from the long process or short, intensive process, whatever it may be, of the caregiving journey that you were just on. So if a person has been taking care of their mother for several months or years, that's taken its toll on them in a whole other way, almost separate from the actual passing of their parent.
Right, exactly.
Because what happens is, you know how sometimes they say, well, it was a blessing. She was suffering and it was not fixable. There was no way out. So it's better that she goes, and then that's the other time when somebody who want maybe timidly raise their hand and saying to that person who's there, to the child who's left, even a child who could be in their 30s, 40s, 60s, you know, who says to say, it's okay for you to feel a sense of relief.
Right.
You know,
that's
okay. You don't have to, that there, you can, you know, it's understandable that you'd feel guilty and feel like there's something wrong with you if you feel relieved that your parent has died. But it's been a long, grueling thing for you, too, that's really compromised and changed, radically changed your life and has affected
mm-hmm.
your health, both physical, emotional, and psychological. And so
right.
that's the healing that has to happen from the sickness itself and the duration of that, how it's affected. It's not just the loss of the person. Those are
mm-hmm.
they're almost two separate things. And I think one of them, they both need time, but they need two different kinds of healing in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a process of letting go. That time really in itself does help, even when it doesn't feel like it does. It doesn't take it away. It doesn't make it all better, but it helps. And so
mm-hmm.
it can only go so fast. You can't necessarily rush that through, but you can take more definitive steps towards the healing from the wear and tear of the caretaking experience.
That
is a crucial distinction to make.
Mm-hmm.
That will help people. Pardon?
No, I said you touched on something really important when you said that it's okay to admit that you're relieved now. That weight has been lifted off of you. I think so many people get hung up right there because they do have this sense of guilt if they admit that they have that weight lifted off of them now. It's almost like they're afraid to say it, which in turn
it's just part of the equation. It's not one or the other. That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in our society, in the Western world, particularly in America with its various religious influences, we got a lot of problems with guilt. You know,
mm-hmm.
we're a slave to guilt from an early age. Even when we reach into the cookie jar as a child, we're already taught to be guilty for eating a cookie before dinner. I mean, and that gets deep set into our DNA. Then if you just take the extension of that, I mean, even to remotely think that you could possibly have a sense of relief that your long-suffering parent has finally gone on to hopefully a better place, in some shape or form, that there's some sense of relief, or there's a sense of relief to, so, well, obviously I'm relieved that I'm not going to be spending, you know, 11 hours a day in the hospital or the nursing home or the rehab or the wherever, or in their home taking care of them all the time and having no life of my own, barely.
Mm-hmm.
That's only human that there would be some sense of relief, but it's not in replace. That sense of relief does not eliminate the hurt and the sadness and the empty space of losing that person. That they coexist. So it's just saying, hey, there's room for that in this equation. There's also room. That's a viable component, and it also will help me get balance. You know, it's like the parent who I could count myself, you know, right in the forefront of these parents
right.
whose children go away to college, and I feel like, well, I'm going to take my daughter to college next Sunday to Philadelphia, and then I may as well just drive my car straight into the Schuylkill River because my life will be over as I've known it for the past 18 years, and it's the most horrible thing I could ever imagine that my little girl's going, you know. I'll
mm-hmm.
get choked up right now on the phone if I talk about this too much. But there's also the part of me that's going, wow, I'm also going to have a new opportunity. I haven't had in 18 years of not looking over my shoulder for what she needs and where I need to be and what I need to have out for her and take care of her or just be available to her,
mm-hmm.
right? And then I'm not going to, I won't need to do that, or I won't, whether I need to or want to or have to, it's out of the equation.
Right.
It just physically will not be an option. So what will, mm-hmm. what new opportunities will that give me that I should make the most of?
And that's true.
It's the same kind of thing. It's like, you know, your parent died, and that's not a good thing, but it also, for every bad, I mean, it's like yin-yang, you know, for something negative, there's a positive. That is the circle of life. It just is. It doesn't even, you know, and we shouldn't feel guilty for seeing it as the truth of our human existence. Because it's just a fact. It's just the facts. And so I think it's helpful for someone to see, try and pull back and see that bigger picture. You were talking before about their stuff and being, they have their living among their stuff. That's a whole battle of letting go. And we always hold on to things longer probably than we need to. We you know, whether we keep them all out on the shelf collecting dust or they're in the closet and we don't look at them, but maybe every 5 or 10 years, and then we think, why do we still have them, you know? And then,
right.
you know, and then when you're forced to physically move, you'll really wonder why you still have it, because you got to carry it now and pack it. I think that, I know when my mom died, my sister and I went through her house, and we had a, you know, pretty peaceful time. Luckily, it was a pretty peaceful time of figuring out things that, well, this would really be good in her house, or I would definitely, this table, I would love to have that in my living room. And then other things are like, I don't have any connection to this. This is something my mother bought that, you know, it's sort of like, did I, just because she was my mother and I loved her in a deep way, did I like every sweater she ever bought for herself? No. So why am I going to keep it? Just because she bought it from a store, somebody in Bangladesh made that sweater. I mean, why am I going to have a connection to it? My mother touched it. Okay, fine, but all I need is, you know, or do I, you know, she had a big collection of Hummel figures. Do I need to keep every single Hummel figure to remember my mom's connection to her Hummel figure? No, I have one Hummel figure. I got rid of all the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, just we have to just get away from. It really, helped to literally lighten the load, you know, literally. And know that those physical, external things are really just the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
And you know, they're more symbolic than anything else. And so we can do with a lot less symbols around us. Same thing like my son. My son had a million trophies from sports when he was little. Do I need to, I mean, keep all of them? They're in this huge box so that whenever I die, they're going to go through my box full of stuff, and he's going to look at all these trophies, and he's going to throw them out too. we just get attached to stuff too much.
We have a comment in the Facebook chat room. Victoria Wright, she said she walked her foster mother through her suffering for the last 2 years of her life, and once it got worse, she asked God to end her suffering because it was heartbreaking to see her suffer and not be able to do anything about it. And we're going to touch on that, too, in a moment, Victoria, but she also writes, she didn't feel relief right away, but she feels a huge sense of relief now. So I wrote back to Victoria and I said, did you have a sense of relief in the fact that you could pick up with your life too? And Victoria writes, yes, but I tell you the truth, I didn't know how. Even though I wanted to do so, much while she was here. I am learning now how to begin to live my life without anyone really depending on me. So,
right. I think we're always learning no matter how old we are. There's still like, we realize, oh, my God, there's new stuff to learn. I find that exciting. It's challenging, or I sometimes kind of laugh and go, oh, my God, I really have to learn this stuff? I was like, okay. It's good to have, you gotta laugh at all this stuff. But I think the first thing, people can't conceive of any sense of relief because they're in an empty space. And that's what's
right.
The first thing. There's a pain of an empty space. And there's also, you know, as Elizabeth Kubler-Ross writes, with the stages of grieving. But in those stages of grieving come the openness towards relief and renewal. Relief isn't just relief. Relief is the key to renewal and rediscovery anew and all of that stuff and reawakening. And those are the things to couple with it. One thing that can help people is to, I wanted to point this out about letting go of things, because I think when we can do this, we also can lighten our spirit, when we actually lighten our physical load, is to write letters, goodbye letters to it. Or, for example, I just make up this as an example. If something from my mother, I remember sending certain things, little trinkets and things that were in my mom's house. I made little packages, and my sister and I, we sent them to our cousins all over the world. A little thing, like a little remembrance, but we wrote letters with it. And the letters, we got the feedback from everybody, oh, thank you, this is great, and we loved your letter, and da-da-da. And I thought, well, that's great, but the letter really did more for me probably than what it did for them, because it helped me get through a painful space.
Mm-hmm.
I gave myself permission to let go of this stuff and to let go of the weight, to let go of not all of the weight, because the weight, some of it's still there, it's normal, but
right.
I let go of some of the weight that gave me a lightness of step to go forward myself. And I think that writing gives us that opportunity, and a lot of times finding in the form of letter writing can really help.
Right.
Or to write a letter to your own child that you may not even give it to them, but to write a letter to your own children about who their grandmother was that they didn't know, because they were either too young or they didn't know her back in the day or whatever. Those are the ways to relive through some of the times that you cherish and be able to leave them on the shelf in a good, positive place and then go on with your own life. And so that's another place where writing can help to let go in a constructive way. And at the same time, provide a gift for other people.
Yes. And, you know, it's so odd that you, once again, you are, I guess we could say that you're enforcing or validating. Last week I had Dr. Susan Allison on, and she said to keep a journal, start journaling, but write it out. And here we are again this week, and you're saying writing helps. It really does, and it's odd that you brought up writing a letter to your child, because in my book, I have a piece that I wrote to my precious one, which is my only child, my son, and I wrote about the things that I missed out on because I had to work and couldn't be there for him, and there was some other, circumstances in between, influencing circumstances at play there. But I didn't get into all of that because that was about connecting with him. That was about sending that message to him so that I can free up and move on and go on with life with a lightened load, as you said. And I think that was another great point that you brought up, is the fact that keep what you must but let go of everything else, because if you're bringing all of these things into your space, that means that you have less space and you're strangling yourself. So you don't have breathing room. You don't have moving room anymore. So we
exactly.
have to learn
oh,
how
exactly.
to keep it.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. You know, in that first wave of losing someone, you know, I don't know whether it's in our culture or what it is. It's just we feel like each of us feel like we have to carry this. It feels like a huge load because it's a huge. Obviously, it's a huge loss, and no one is. I mean, I would never suggest anything other than that. But there's nowhere where it says there's no law or there's no thing that says how much anyone has to continue to carry. You know, it's sort of like this is the first time when you. The first time, I can't remember when it was, honestly, but I remember it happening, that first day when I said to myself, wow, I didn't think about my mom today. And I felt like, oh, my God, what's wrong with me? You know,
right.
I must be a terrible person. My mom just died, however, whether it was weeks or months before, and I didn't think of her for like hours of that day or for the most part of the day. Suddenly, like in the afternoon, I'd be walking somewhere and I'd think, I've been up since 7 o'clock in the morning. I haven't thought of her since yesterday. I'm like, what's, you know, and then I realized I had to just let myself realize that was okay. That it wasn't an indictment of my humanity or suddenly say, well, yeah, you were the bad son you thought you were. Now you don't even look, you don't want a whole day, you didn't even think about your dead mother. I was like, well, and then it was a revelation to find out that it had nothing, didn't mean anything.
Right.
It really
right.
didn't mean anything, one way or the other.
And I think you just hit on something that so many people were probably right now having that aha moment. They're having that epiphany where it's like, oh my gosh, he just said something that so many people have gone through, because so many people, it's almost like they feel obligated. I must keep this person on the forefront of my brain for the rest of my life. You love them. The thing is, the most important part is that you loved and honored and cherished them when they were living. When they were living.
Exactly. And if they loved you, if they really loved you in a healthy way, they don't want you walking around mourning them all the time, having no life
of
your own.
Exactly. Exactly. Anybody who knows me right now, friends, family, neighbors, when I'm gone, remember the good quirky parts. If it's something that I did or said that made you laugh, take that with you so in your darkest moments, remember that and laugh until you have no more breath to laugh with you. But the rest of it, please, let me go. Let me go. I've been to the other side. I saw how beautiful it is. I didn't want to come back last year. But the great I am, you know, that's a story for another day. But when we take that last breath and we go to the other side and we get a taste of it and we hear that infamous word, that it's not our time and we have something left to do here, and suddenly we find ourselves back here. Trust me, when I go, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to miss you guys. I'm going to love you, but that's another part of the journey of this thing called life. Death is just another part of it. It's called the circle of life for a reason.
Yeah,
and it's just
really
a part of it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, and you know, and then the other thing is you know, it's almost as if, excuse me, we are shocked to remember that, oh, my God, it's going to happen to me too.
Right.
But it's also, but the first thing is, well, if things happen in the way that the circle of life does prescribe, that we lose as we lose a parent before we lose a child, and hopefully that is the case, but that, you know, that's what happens. It's
mm-hmm.
just, and so there isn't any one way that is the only way or the right way to process it. It's just like, you know, everybody shows their grief in a different way. I mean, at a funeral, for example, some people are so overtly, openly emotional and crying and need assistance to even walk
mm-hmm.
across the grass. Other people are quite calm and collected. Does that mean that they loved their parent less than the other one? No. There isn't that doesn't make any sense. So why then do we judge ourselves if we didn't think of our parents for a certain amount of hours, or we feel there's a certain sense of relief, or we can throw out the sweater going, God, that sweater was so ugly anyway. I told her it was ugly when she bought it, and now years later when she died, I'm going to keep it because I love how ugly it is? I mean, you know, it's just, right? So, you know, it's just, we get really crazy
about
it.
That's a good way to put it. Oh,
yeah,
we get ourselves so
twisted. It's remarkable.
Yes, and it's true, people. So it's okay. You know, don't feel guilty once they're gone. Because I'm telling you now, if I was on the other side, I don't want you to take up all of your life, your living lifetime, you know, filling it with my dead memories. It's okay. Remember the good times. One or two of them is great. You know, if I made you laugh and we had the best time of our lives, take that with you and remember it when you need to. But everything else, you know, just because
I actually am going to leave directions for my children to flog themselves like once a month for all the things that they shortchange. Just a 5-minute flogging, you know, on the first of every month. But
if that'll make them feel better.
What's that?
I said if that'll make them their guilt feel a little better. You know what? I want you to take this bat and just bang yourself a couple times.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah. Don't create blood. I don't want you to like bleed
right.
and everything, have to go to the emergency room. No concussions, but just some light flogging. Just like 5 minutes of guilt and then go out and, you know, go out and
five
have
minutes
dinner.
Of guilt a day. That'll be your new book. 5 minutes of guilt a day.
Yeah, right. No, not every day. No, just once a month. I don't want to, you know.
Oh, once
right
a month. Oh, my God. Yeah, 5 minutes a month. That's it. 5 minutes a month. That's it. That's all you need. Problem solved, you know.
Yeah,
you
really.
Flog your guilt away. Oh.
I mean, our culture just at every turn, it's looking to lay on guilt trips, you know. And I grew up with that with my mom. Honestly, she had it with her mom, and so I've really tried to, you know, figure my way out of it with myself, starting with myself, and then with what I lay
right.
on my own kids. And so I hope I've done, you know, a decent job of it, but it really takes work. It takes
right.
you know, you have to really, you know, it takes mindfulness to do it. And
it does.
But it's all, you know what it all boils down to? It all boils down to letting go. And guilt is
mm-hmm.
all just a thing. Guilt is all a result of people not letting go.
And you know what? We have a comment right here in the chat room. Victoria says she has some things with her that she never wear and she's never going to use, but she feels badly if she threw them away. Well, if you don't have to throw them away unless they're really something that can do no one else any good. If there's something that's usable, donate them. Find some of the charities out there who'd be more than happy.
There's
to
many, many charities out
those.
There. There's so many out there. And you know what?
Yes.
If you really want to leave something, a legacy of your loved one who wore those clothing, well then write a little note saying to the person who just bought this ugly sweater. No, I'm sorry. To the person who just bought this sweater at a thrift store, whatever. I want you to know that my mother wore this for 2 decades, and when she wore it, she made the best chocolate chip cookies for our family.
Right.
Because she was always wearing that sweater when she was in the kitchen. Whatever. I'm just making this story up as an example. But
right.
And then that person takes it home and they find this little note in it. What a remarkable moment that would be. That
right.
they're gonna then they appreciate that. They don't never met the woman, but they appreciate it. It's almost like a time capsule thing
right.
that are so cool to find, you know, and why not? do you know, something like that, where you feel like when you're giving it away, then you're giving it away with a piece of, you know, that loved one, you know, within it, and that might make the act of giving it away have enough meaning to enable you then to do it.
Yes, and I think that it helps to their memory to carry on through your donations, because that sweater that you're never going to wear, you don't want to get rid of it, you know, it's ugly as sin, but hey, that person who has no sweater at all when winter's coming is going to think it's the most beautiful thing in the world.
Right, but you know what, there's a bit of, and if it's not writing it to put it in the pocket there, it's like you have a cousin who knows what you're dealing with. And you're right, even if it's an email or you get on the phone, you say, you talk to your cousin, you say, hey, I just packed up today these clothes from Mom, and I took them to the Salvation Army. And do you remember when she wore this, or do you remember when she wore that, and this, and this, and this, and this? And so you reminisce a little bit about it, and you know, you got a few tears, you got a few laughs, and you make almost like a ritual or a ceremony around it, in a light enough way that you can, you give it away, and you I think you end up, it's a positive thing to do.
Yes, and that's just a suggestion to you, Victoria. But yeah, I would think that go through, keep a few things that are usable to you that you really do love. You love them when they were living, and you love it now, and you're sure that they would love for you to have it if it's bringing you joy. So you keep that, but all the other things, let it go so that you can have your living space. Once you get back your living space, then you will then figure out.
And
ways
you don't need
to
do it. You don't have to give. Just start. Give a couple things away to start and see that it feels okay. And then you don't have to pack up, you know, a super-sized garbage bag full of stuff or an enormous box. And then it's like, oh my God, it's all or nothing. Just start with a little bit and see what that feels like. And then when you realize, oh, that wasn't so bad. That actually. Okay, now next week or next month, or you start to say, well, every time I go, you know, to the dry cleaner, which is next to the Goodwill store, I'll bring another little thing with me, and do it. Like when I was moving recently, I made a little game with myself that every time I left my apartment, I had to get rid of something because I knew I wanted to downsize all my stuff just across the board. I wanted to. Just like how many T-shirts do I have that I don't really, I don't wear, and they're still sitting in a drawer. And I know I'll never wear them. So I would say, okay, whether it's a T-shirt or a pair of socks that have holes in it, why am I keeping them? Or some like drawings, little stick figures my daughter made in kindergarten, which I have 25 of them. Do I need all 25 of them? You know, they're all the same stick. It's just in different colors.
Yeah.
You know, it's like ridiculous. And it takes up a lot of space. And so I would get rid of something every day, either some stuff that I actually would throw away or other things I would drop off at a used bookstore or at the Goodwill or whatever, or just put in the trunk of my car to get out of my house. And then I would eventually, next time I drove the car, I would take it somewhere. And I would make myself do that every time I left the house, even just one little thing. And it did get into some of the little knickknacks I had from my mom that were on my bookshelf just collecting dust. And I was like, why do I have this thimble from Bermuda that I bought for her 25 years ago when I was in Bermuda and brought her back a thimble because she sews with thimbles. She doesn't sew anymore. She's not here anymore. And so do I need the whole collection of thimbles that I bought for her, or do I just want to keep a couple of them? So, you know, when I got rid of them, I dropped them off and gave them away, then it was really a positive experience.
Right. And I know that for me, this is me again, all the listeners, this is me. I know that if I found myself in that type of a predicament, I'm going to start giving away things and taking care of that while I'm still healthy enough to do it, because that's a burden that I don't want to leave for those who will be left behind. I don't want them to have to go through this, so I'm going to divvy up things. And, you know, it was so funny, my nephew, many years ago, he was much younger, and he liked a lot of things as long as a gizmo and gadget kind of auntie. And he said, when you die, can I have this, this, and this? I'm like, wow, okay. Well, he had already put in his dibs on what he wanted, you know, many years ago, and I'm still here, so he still doesn't have what he wants. But I'm going to clean out things myself, because guess what? If I find myself with some type of an illness that's a deterrent for me, I want to have all the living space I can have. I want to be able to run around to every corner and not hit unnecessary items that I won't be needing anymore, or that I haven't used in years anyway. I have a lot of things like that now, so I know that for me, I'm going to clean house myself, so they won't have to worry about that burden. Everybody would know what was meant for them to have, and the rest, give it away or get a roll away and just clean out the house and deal with that.
No, absolutely. But I think that there's maybe something deeper going on with when we hold on to stuff. Because when we keep clutter around ourselves, it becomes a crutch, and it becomes like a filter keeping us from really dealing with ourselves and making choices and committing to things for ourselves. It's easier for me to say, if I've got, all this stuff around from other people, then it's just keeping me from really clarifying what I want for myself.
Right.
And that's, in the end, that's not really going to help. You know, but I think that there's a lot of ways that we can use. Again, I come back to writing because it's something that I find a lot of good use for, and I know that it's tangibly helped so many people that I've worked with. It helps to let go. It helps, obviously. It has really big value for communicating in the moment and in a situation around that anybody's situation around cancer. Same thing for doctors and nurses and people, for them to write reflectively about their experience is a healthy thing for them. But just simply when we are facing loss, or we're dealing with loss, or we're facing it, it's impending, it can help us process it and help us in the mechanism of letting go. And so, I highly recommend it.
Yes. So clean house one way or the other, before, after, but get it out so that you can have that breathing space and that living space.
Exactly.
Again, for those of you in the call query, if you have a question or a comment before we end our show, feel free to press the number 1 on your phone now, and I will bring you on air. I'm going back over to our Facebook group to see if there's any comments there. And, of course, to our guests who are in the show chat room, if you're logged in as a guest and you'd like to get involved in our conversation before our show ends, you can either sign off and log back in under screen name or give us a call at 646-478-4726. I believe that in our conversation alone, we answered a lot of the questions from those of the people who are in my coaching group who could not join us because of the time difference, but they'll be hearing the show, of course, in its entirety. And everyone, if you joined us late, you'll be able to hear our show in its entirety. After it ends, give me about 2 minutes or so. It should be up within that time for you to come back and share the show with all of your friends, because it's really good advice to help you make it through this transitional time when you are the caregiver or you are the person suffering from this type of illness that we call cancer. When you get that roadblock in the way, you know, there's ways that you can continue to live and enjoy every moment of it. Don't let cancer take control of your life. But, you know, David, one of the things that I loved about this show is the fact that this information, it doesn't just have to apply to cancer. It can apply to so many different things.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, hopefully, you know, cancer is a temporary thing for people. Although, you know, once you've had it, you kind of, even when you're in survivorship, you're surviving a thing. But still, it's like you said, it's not just about that specific thing. I think these principles could be applied to anything, really. Yeah, I mean, just simply the idea of going to the doctor. You can go to the. You really want to be prepared when you go to the doctor to make it the most useful 15 or 20 minutes you can.
Right.
And the idea about better communication with your loved ones and your coworkers and things. Who could argue with that, right?
Yes.
So, you know if there's any anyone who has any questions after this or wants to communicate with me at all, mm-hmm. if they could do that, if they do that through you, and then you can forward that to me, or do they need a more direct way?
You can share your information. Yeah, you can share your information where they can get a copy of your book, how they can reach you, and of course.
Well, the book, Right for Life, they can go on Amazon to order that, and they can, on my website, which is just my last name, tabatsky.com, T-A-B-A-T-S-K-Y, on tabatsky.com. They can contact me through that, or on rightforlife.info. Those are two different websites, tabatsky.com or rightforlife.info. They can reach me that way. Okay.
That's okay. Everybody have that, tabatsky.com or rightforlife.com, was it?
Dot info.
And tabatsky.com. Reach out. You know, David is offering to be there for you. You're not alone. That's the one thing that I love about this, is that I like telling people, as you can see, you're not alone. There are so many people in this world who've gone through this, who have similar, very like situations. And it still amazes me, David, every time I do a show and I hear people's stories and things, and I'm like, oh, my gosh. You know, that's just like what five other people have gone through, or what, you know, 50 of the people in my group. So I have over 400 people in one of my largest coaching groups. So I work with a lot of people all over the world. These are just my smaller groups. But the thing is that, people, you're not alone. This is great advice, and some of you didn't know what to do. You were sitting here, and some of the questions that I get is, what am I supposed to do? And a lot of times you really do have to sit back for a while, give yourself that time to heal and to regroup, reassess, realign, and then move on from there. And back over in our Facebook chat room, Victoria writes, she donated a majority of her foster mom's things, but she has some cosmetic jewelry that she loved. And see, Victoria, the key word is that she loved it. She loved it. If you don't love it, two things I would suggest you do. Have it appraised to make sure, because nowadays older cosmetic jewelry has some value to it. And if you find that it doesn't and you really don't like it, hey, Goodwill, Salvation Army, give it away.
Well, who is it doing any good if it's sitting inside a drawer? So if you can sell it and then donate some of the money to one of your mom's, you know, favored charities, and then
donate it in her name.
Donate in her name, keep one piece of it. It's like the Hummel figures. You know, I kept one Hummel. I think I kept two, actually. Two Hummel figures out of like 30 of them. Because I don't know how, I don't remember what I did with the others. I think they went through an auction house or something. But they weren't useful to me, or I wouldn't put them on a shelf somewhere. I wasn't really going to look at them every day. But I have these two, and that's kind of like the special little thing. I like to know that I have them. But that sort of takes care of the whole set. I think some people need suggestions, really, even where to begin. But I think maybe Maria, the majority of people just need a reminder, or need to be reminded that they can give themselves permission to do what their instincts are already telling them. that it really is okay. Yeah, I think that that's probably more often the case. We stop because we feel like there's something wrong with those choices.
Right.
As if there's a superstition that, you know, God will, you know, I don't know, make a storm come or something if we give away one of our mother's sweaters, one too many sweaters.
Right.
Yeah.
Or any loved one, you know, it could be a parent, it could be a spouse.
No, I don't know. Of course, it doesn't have to be a spouse. Yeah, anything.
Yeah, you know, I'm just adding that because so many people might, you know, sometimes people get fixated on the one thing where they were just talking about parent. No, it's for someone who you have
No, it
lost.
Could be anybody. It could be anyone.
Could be.
But I think also everybody has to do that in their own thing. So like, I want to reiterate again, it doesn't, it's not all or nothing. It just... Start with one thing and find.
Baby steps, just baby steps.
Yeah, just dose it out. What feels manageable and what doesn't feel threatening, doesn't feel upsetting. Just do one thing and try that, and you see that that goes okay. Then you can, you know, you continue it, and then you start to make it a ritual. You say, well, maybe, you know, every Saturday for the next month when I'm relaxed, I'm not racing off to work, I'm not running home fast to cook dinner for everybody, I have a little time for myself, that's when I'm going to pay attention to this, and I'm going to make the letting go something meaningful. It's not just going to be something because I'm making myself do it, but that you do it, you know, do it in a way that has, you know, has meaning for you.
Yes, and I think that, you know, to look at it in another way, there's things that once they've run their course with me, I don't like them anymore. There may be something that I liked when I first brought it, but 2 years down the road, it's out of style. I can't fit it anymore. I'm going to get rid of it. So if I'm getting rid of things that I used to love but I don't, they were for me, and I love me best of all, you know, you don't have to hold on to the things for those who have gone now, especially like so many of us have already admitted, there are things that we didn't really like in the first place. So you can let them go, but don't let, as you said, donate them in your loved one's name. That helps to keep their legacy and their memory alive and moving on, and it continues through their legacy and that donation. And winter is coming. Winter is coming. Some people, like, they have programs that's called, like, Dress for Success for people who are less fortunate, who are trying to get out there in the work world. So that costume jewelry may be that wonderful accessory that someone needs for their outfit to really make them feel wonderful and stand out and just give them that sense of, you know, self-esteem boost that they would need. So, again, there's so many ways to keep those memories alive and so that you can move on without holding on to all of that, those items and things that are essentially just, you know, choking the life out of you. And you're still here. So that means that you're meant to live. And so you have to, at your pace, just let it go and get your freedom back in your breathing space. And that's it. So, again, to all of our guests, again, if you're here, welcome to all of the guests joining us in the chat room. Thank you so much. Hello from Sister Tina Hobson from I Am a Superwoman Radio. She's just joining us. Victoria, of course, with Prince, and all of our guests. Thank you for being here, and all of our people in the call query, thank you for being here. And all of our participants over on Facebook and our events page, thank you for all of your comments this evening. Again, we have about 15 minutes. So if you have a question or a comment, we'll give you a few moments to say it now. I'll turn it over to David for some final words here. And again, we'll check back with you all to see if you have any questions or comments. For those of you in the call query, press the number 1 on your phone, and I'll bring you on air. And, David, while you're giving your closing comments, I'll go back over here and see if there's any more feedback in our Facebook event.
Is there anybody on the phone who had a question that you're looking at?
They haven't pressed one on their phone, so
okay.
They're just listening. Oh, yes, we do. We do have someone now. So here
okay.
we go. Caller, last four, 4632, 4632. Welcome, welcome. You're on the air with David Tabatsky and I here on Healing Through Hurt, iTalk Radio.
Hi, C. Maria and David. This is Marcella Moore.
There she is.
tonight, and before I say anything, C. Maria, I just want to thank you because you told me that when you did these last couple of calls, you did them with me in mind, and I certainly do appreciate it. And I have thoroughly enjoyed everything that I've heard tonight. I'll definitely go back and listen to the playback, but everything that I heard from you, C. Maria, and David as well was very helpful. David, I recently lost my mom on July 7th to a two-year battle with lung and then brain cancer. And
I'm sorry.
Fought a good fight. So I am in the early stages of this. I've experienced death before. My dad died when he was 45 and I was 25, but this was certainly much different, I guess because of the longevity and that I had with my mom and just going through the process of her with her through it all. So your information is definitely helpful, not only for myself, but I've talked to tons of people who I have prayed for and helped walk through their process, and definitely your information is just very helpful. So I thank you for accepting C. Maria's invitation to come on tonight. And C. Maria, I thank you for your thoughtfulness and your kindness and just, you know, doing this because awareness is a wonderful thing. And then there's some things we just need to talk about. So thank you both. And I wanted to let you know that I was here. I came in late, but I certainly did make it on the call tonight. Thank you.
Oh, well.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say one thing in response. I don't know if you were listening before when we were talking about this in particular. You said it yourself, this long two-year track that you were on, and then the what happens when you lose your mom. And in a way, they seem inseparable because they literally played out as one part of your life. But in a way, what you're going forward dealing with is almost two separate things. We were talking about this before. One of them is there's an empty space, and there's no denying that. I know that from my own experience. But I felt when my mom died after a long series of different illnesses, I needed to put myself back together. I needed to heal from the experience of that, from the caretaking and from seeing and observing that failure and all of those conversations with doctors and all the not knowing and the fear and the uncertainty and the feeling of not being able to help her and that powerlessness and all of those things. But they were separate in a way. All of them were temporarily erased when she died, and all I could see was the emptiness and the what I was missing in her not being here anymore. But then I realized that's just something that only time will help me cope with. But the other stuff, I had to take an active path towards healing was what that long stretch of taking care of her and all of those other things I just mentioned, what toll that took on me, intellectually, mm-hmm. emotionally, psychologically. And I had to find a way to intentionally put myself back together from that. And see, okay, now what did I get from that? What gifts did I actually learn? What did I learn from that? How did that make me actually not less of a person? It made me a bigger person. I feel, on the one hand, because she died, I feel like nothing. I feel tiny. My mommy's gone. You know, you feel like no matter, I'm a grown man, but you still have that feeling as a child. But in fact, that whole process of the last year or two, enlarges you. It doesn't reduce you. And so when I figured that out, that really helped me. And that energy that I gave myself from that, and with energy that it gave me, that education gave me, also has helped me be stronger to deal with the loss. Am I making sense with that?
Oh, you are so on point, and definitely, because one thing that I have understood by God's grace, and not because of my own, I do understand that it was two things, and that I needed to deal with them, such as that, and I have, and I continue to do so. I don't know how or why I was able to have that awareness and understanding that, because the energy, even in that process, the energy of understanding that my territory was being enlarged through that process of everything that you said, treatments and going to the doctor and all that, that was the energy that helped me continue. That was the energy that gave me strength to endure the process. And so then once I got to the part of her leaving, even though she was sick, I left her one day and she was okay. She had been in ICU and all of that, and times when they just said there's nothing that we can do, and she woke up the next day and she survived. But this piece for me is that I left her. She was in good spirits and everything. I left her on a Saturday evening, kissed her, said, "I'll see you tomorrow." She said, "Okay, I'll see you tomorrow." And then in the morning, I received the call that she was gone. So it's just the whole dynamic of it, and just for me, the whole process, God, and that's how I have to identify this for myself, because I know that it was a higher power and has given me the ability and the awareness to really dissect this thing in a way where it has made me better. So I hope I'm making sense in what I'm saying, and basically I'm agreeing with you, and I mean, you hit the nail on the head right there. It's definitely two separate issues.
And one of them can only go at its own pace.
Right.
You know, and that's the raw thing that you're really still, I mean, it's just been a month since your mother died that, you know, there's no dancing around that fact, and that it just that just takes time, and there's nothing,
right.
you can't push that any further, you know. But you can, you know, but it's like, it's, you know, this may sound superficial, but it's sort of like a wound, a physical wound, and the doctor says, well, you know, don't keep it covered in a Band-Aid all the time. Let it get some fresh air and some sun. That'll help your skin heal. Well, there's something to be said for that. And what we do when we are in mourning is to also let a little sun in, you know, that we don't need to, in the Jewish faith that I grew up in, there's a very, very specific designated rituals of mourning that one goes through, with the first 7 days, the first 30 days, and the first year. And it has some pretty great healing built into it. But it also has a certain thing where it's basically telling you, get off your ass and get back into the world, you know, and open the windows and let some fresh air come in and go out. You don't have to go out dancing, right? In fact, you're not supposed to during this time, but you're supposed to go out into the world, and you can laugh and you can see your friends, you know, and dose it so you bring yourself back to life.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a really important thing to be cognizant of, and you have to remind. It's like anything else. It's daily mindfulness.
Yes. All makes sense to
And may I add that, you know, Sister Marcella has been so strong during this entire process and things, and I hope in some small way that tonight you can let your guards down and show your vulnerable side and share what you're going through and just be that person who's sitting in the audience for once and just digesting the information that's for you, as opposed to you being that strong come-to person where everybody comes to you for everything. And, you know, and that's why I said I dedicated last week and this week to you, because I felt what you were going through. You know me. I'm that intuitive, and I feel things, and I hope that in some way that this did help you in your journey, so to speak, because if that's the case, then, you know, the job was well done from David and Susan last week and myself. So, again, my sister, I love you, and this was for you, and I'm so glad that you pressed the one on your phone to call in and share for a while. But we are, unfortunately, now we're running out of time. So, David, again, give us all of your contact information so that Marcella can touch bases with you.
Well, I just want to say also, Marcella, you know, you're helping other people by putting yourself out on the line and saying, hey, I'm hurting here. I'm trying to figure out my own way to navigate through this. You're also, there's a lot of other people, whether they're actively listening right now or they'll get wind of this some other time, I hope, is that they're dealing with something similar and trying to figure out their way. So you are giving them a helping hand by calling attention, you know, to your own, you know, to your own situation. So I would thank you for doing that. You know, if people want to get in touch with me, they can go on my website at www.tabatsky.com, T-A-B-A-T-S-K-Y, tabatsky.com, or to get more information about Right for Life, they can go to rightforlife.info.
Thank you so much.
And Maria, thank you. Thank you. I've really, really been touched a lot by sharing this time with you and talking about this. And I look forward to talking to you again, when we're not on the air.
Yes, thank you. And we have some comments. We have about 2 minutes left, but we have a lot of comments over in our Facebook chat room. Melanie Inspires Promise writes, really good content shared. Thank you. And she also writes to Sister Marcella. She said she's praying for you continually. And Ann Thomas writes, awesome show, C. Maria Wall. Like you said, it doesn't apply to cancer only. Thanks for this informative show. And Anne also writes, wow, that's good. Healing from the caretaking experience of self, feelings of failure, convos with the doctors, et cetera. Wow, they really are two different processes to heal from. Deep and very insightful. And one more comment before we go. I believe, give me a moment to get this up here. I just saw it a second ago. I believe Sister Marcella received tonight, because David said a lot that seemed to already confirm the healing process she is in. Good to receive, my love. Like C. Maria said, you're always there for others. God reached down and kissed you personally tonight by letting you know you are on the right track. Warrior Princess, I love you. So, again, these were all of the comments from the chat room. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Thank you, David, so much. And, yes, we must keep in touch behind the scenes after this. Yes, yes, yes. That's what makes this show so wonderful, is that you come here as my guest, you leave here as my friend. So, once again,
I'll vote for that,
Thank you again. Thank you so much. And to everyone, I'm even going to tomorrow morning. I will not have a Sunday morning inspiration, but we will be back here again next week, where my special guest will be Sister Ann Thomas. She's coming here to do chapter reading and discussion from her book, The Consecrated Cocoon. We will be back again on the 17th with our regular Sunday morning inspiration at 6 a.m., where my topic will be brush yourself off and walk it out. So until then, thank you, everyone. Thank you, David, for being here. My special guest tonight has been David Tabatsky. And the name of his book is Right for Life, Communicating Your Way Through Cancer. Thank you so much, Sister Marcella.
Thank you, Maria.
Many blessings to you. And thank you so much, David. You have a wonderful evening. Thank you to all of our listeners in the chat room and, of course, in our call, Corey, and over on Facebook. Thank you so much. And they are still talking on the Facebook chat room. Oh, my goodness. Love you, Sister Marcella. Great show tonight. As always, see Maria Wall. Great show. Thank you so much to everyone. Great show and very informative. And thanks to you, David, as well. So, again, David, people love you. They love the advice you gave. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful conversation this evening. As always, before I go, I pray each and every one of you enough. I pray you enough sunshine to brighten your rainy days. I also pray you enough rain to make your gardens grow beautifully. And I pray you enough smiles to turn that frown you've been carrying around upside down. But most of all, I pray you enough strength and courage to face whatever you may be going through this week and beyond. So until next time, as always, I am your most appreciative and humble host, C. Maria Wall, the visionary, a.k.a. the mediator, the Shiro at your ground zero, reminding each and every one of you to continue to pay it and pray it forward. So until next time, thank you so much for being here. Be well, be blessed, and I will see you back here again soon. Take care, everyone. Have a wonderful remainder of your week. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Good night, everyone. Thank you, David. Thank you, Sister
Good night.
Marcella. I'm sure I'll catch you all on Facebook. Be well, be blessed. Good night.
My brown sugar for a bit of pop. If love really was a bullet, I'd have took the shot. Yeah. Now would you buy me a drink just to take me home? Put your game in a song just to make me moan. I like my Robin Thicke, me alone. A thug out bone. Triple shots, that's the trait.
I get lost in your words. It feels so good when I'm hurt. Take my mind off of the pain. Love when the beat takes me away with only good music. Oh, 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 with only good music.
this concludes our broadcast evening. As I said, I will not be here tomorrow for our Sunday morning inspiration. I will be returning on August the 17th at 6 a.m. and this time next week for a regular Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. Ann Thomas is returning for Authors Month. She will be doing a chapter reading and discussion. So mark your calendars, pass the shows along. I hope that you will join us then. So until then, be well, be blessed, and I will see you soon. Have a wonderful, wonderful, beautiful remainder of your weekend and your upcoming week.